and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a fun show for you this evening. I have Chris O'Brien, a great ufologist for many years. He actually made the trek out here. He's living in New York currently and made the trek up here. He's currently, I don't know if he's going to say this, but he's currently eating lobster in the guest house right now. So he'll be over and be joining us in a bit. Before that, I have Alejandro Rojas with the UFO updates. And we are on KGRA Radio, and it's a real pleasure to be on that station. We're also on YouTube Live, and you can also even see it on our website and over to KGRA Radio. And so we're going to be talking about all kinds of things tonight. By the way, I do appreciate anyone that helps us out, anyone that supports the show. Thanks so much. And anyone, anywhere can help us out. That information's on my website, podcastufo.com. And also we have a conditional blog writer who's going to be sending us some blogs, so we'll see how that goes. So check that website out. Also, there's a UFO sightings page. And if you had a UFO sighting and you want to remain anonymous, we have an anonymous form to fill out. There's some pretty good sightings, and check that out when you get some time. So that's it for me blabbing away. Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Chris will be coming in, walking in any minute when he finishes his dinner.
He's in one of the libraries because there's several libraries, right? We were talking about this in
your estate. Yeah, it's kind of a crazy place. There's four of them.
Whoa. So,
yeah. But anyway, a place needs a lot of work. I'd never own a place like this if I could never afford a place like this if it didn't need so much work. That's all. Mm-hmm. That's all I got to say.
Is it haunted?
Not yet.
Really? With libraries, it seems hauntings come with them.
Yeah. Well, I plan to haunt the place, you know, so
okay.
I'll take care of that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
So what's going on with the UFO news this week?
UFO news. Let's see. There was some ruckus that was made by Mr. Frank Kimbler. So Kimbler is a guy, and we broke this story at openminds.tv, actually. He is a earth sciences and geology teacher at the high school and college level at the Military Institute in New Mexico, which happens to be in Roswell. It's really cool. If you've been to Roswell, you could see this at this estate. It's cool. In fact, sometimes there are events that were held at their big auditorium. They have this big old auditorium where with plays and stuff they used to hold. Neat place. So Frank, years ago, something like maybe 10 years ago, he moved out there to teach at this military institute, and he decided, hey, you know, since this is my specialty, geology and stuff, it might be kind of fun to look into this whole Roswell thing and see if there's anything to it. He decided what he would do is look at satellite photos or aerial photos of the land where the alleged crash site was and see if he sees anything interesting. Well, he did. He found some areas that he thought looked like they were maybe burnt. And he thought, that would be interesting if they, you know, burned an area to kind of get rid of debris and stuff. So he focused on these areas, took his metal detector, and he found a lot of, you know, mundane stuff, but he did find some things that were interesting. One of those pieces he took to a lab, essentially, to get analyzed, and he did this in conjunction with the UFO Museum out there. Sure enough, they came back, and the isotopic research was kind of different. There are a lot of different analysis that can happen, and there's some people that were like, how come he didn't do this analysis or that analysis? And he did do several, but most of those, like electromicroscopy, I always get that word mixed up. Essentially, what those will do, they'll look at the components and the elements of the metal. But and that's interesting. But for the most stuff, you know, all the space stuff is all the same. You know, what we have in our solar system is what's in all the other solar systems.
Right.
So what you really need to look for is something that looks to be manufactured in a manner that we couldn't have done, and something that was off-world, that comes from, you know, elsewhere. So sure enough, this first analysis that he had done showed it was not material from this planet, but it was a manufactured material. So that's very promising. I mean, that's the key. That's what we're looking for. It was in the area of error. very far off. And the thing is that, you know, they give you, okay, it could be error, but the whole point is we don't make errors like this big. So there's no way we don't think it's an error, but it could be. So we needed further analysis done, and I've helped him with a couple situations that have just been weird that didn't work out. He's had a couple situations he's worked with, including with Bigelow, and that didn't really work out. So he's on the brink. He's had some more analysis done, and he's got some more on the way, and he feels he's very close to that this stuff is, you know, ET in nature, and he didn't even want to tell anybody until recently because, you know, and the reason why he came out about it just the other day is that the BLM came knocking at the door and said, hey, you know, this was BLM land where you collected this stuff. We want to take a look and make sure you're doing the right thing. And Frank kind of freaked out. I mean, he got scared. As you could imagine, you know, the prospect of all this work kind of going down the tubes and them taking the material away, he was really scared. Although he did follow their rules. There's a handbook that talks about the rules. We posted it on our story at openminds.tv. And he did follow the rules. The you can take material as long as it's a reasonable amount. And, of course, he hasn't taken much, not even a pound worth probably. And it has to be historically or culturally significant. And this material has not proven to be that yet. Hopefully, Frank will prove it to be that. And then, you know, the BLM would then have a legitimate case to take it. But, of course, if they said this was significant and they did take it, that would prove Frank's point that it was interesting. So he was freaking out because they wanted to look at it this morning or yesterday morning on Monday. And so I have an update, which is that they did look at it. Frank says they didn't take anything away from him, so he's happy about that. But he's still kind of scared because he says they still might at any moment they could do that. So, and the reason this all came about is interesting, too, because the Roswell Festival is coming up. It's next weekend? Not this weekend, but the next weekend, the weekend after July 4th. And I'll be there speaking, of course, at the museum as usual, or I'm always speaking there somewhere. And what happened is they were going to take people to the site, and BLM caught wind of that and said, hey, wait, you can't take a bunch of people out there. You got to check with us before you have any events or anything. And we don't want this area trampled on, and it's not necessarily that easy to get to anyway. And so they were denying them, and the people were like, well, Frank went out there, and that's how they were like, oh, yeah, Frank? Who's this Frank? We want to talk to this Frank guy. And so that's kind of how this all came about.
Wow. So are you going to be hearing from him eventually? You know,
well, I did hear from him. That's what, and he said, yeah, they're not taking anything, but he's still worried that they could.
All right. I'm sorry. I just got a little distracted here. I didn't catch that part. I'm sorry.
Did you get lost in the library?
No. Just Chris came in, and we have to change something real quickly. So I'm going to have to get up for a second, but Chris is right here. Okay. Say hi, Chris.
Alejandro.
Hey.
How's it going, man?
Mr. O'Brien.
I haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah, it has been a little while, and you've been traveling around.
I have indeed. Oh, man. Boy, it's been a lot of miles here in the last month.
Yeah, it sounds
big time.
Like it.
I did
cool.
Conflict in the Desert. Yeah, that was...
that was. Were you conflicting with people? That's kind of what you do.
No. It's just that they had me tucked away in a small, dark little room. So that I didn't come out and you know, harm anybody or insult anybody.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing, but...
I ended up getting in trouble, so...
Yeah, I'm sure. But, I mean, it can be difficult, especially at that event, because there are some pretty strange things being said. And, I mean, I've even been present where, you know, people want me to say that there was... an alien that was a guest in my talk or something like that, and it's like no. And I think I don't know if they genuinely believe those things, but I think they kind of do. At least some people
they do. Let me assure you, they do. This is the tidal flats where the New Age washes over and then recedes at low tide on the beach of Ufology. And it's a very, very frightening experience to be subjected to the type of energy, to borrow the parlance, the type of energy that pervades these types of events. Of course, this year was the first year that they were indoors at quite a fancy place. And I unfortunately had the job of mastering, editing and mastering all the talks as they came hot off the canvas.
Oh, wow.
And I was working six computers at once for an average of about 17 hours a day for 4 days. It was a madhouse.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. But it was, you know, I mean, what can I say? You know, it was eye-opening.
Yeah, eye-opening. Potentially not as educational as you would like, you know, lectures to be, but eye-opening nonetheless. And, and like you said, it can be, I mean, it's a bit scary. This the kind of fringe ideas and the kind of unsubstantiated kind of belief can be fun and interesting to at times, but especially in more recent times, there's times where it does get a little more frightening.
I call it, you know, you've heard of Hitchcockian, right? Well, this is Wilcockian.
That's really good. I love that.
Yeah, and I coined the coin. I should trademark it because it's definitely appropriate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there's just some people like speculation and speculation for speculation's sake, and that's great. But
it's not speculation. Not it's claims that are off the charts. That I'm sorry. I don't believe that Emery Smith autopsied 3,000 aliens. I'm sorry. You know, sorry. No.
Yeah.
Well, I'm back. And thank you, Chris. We'll be bringing you back in.
Yeah, now so, that you went away, we were able to have some discussion that'll generate some emails for you.
That's what happens, yeah. So, anyway, anything else cooking in the UFO topic that you want to talk about, Alejandro?
I guess we've kind of talked about everything else that's gone on. You know, on Den of Geek, I guess the only addition I have to this whole Nimitz situation is that I did write a story recently, and it does have some input from Luis Elizondo and Leslie Kane. And I think what's really interesting from Jeremy Corbell, because I think he's going to have some really interesting stuff coming out soon. And he is. I mean, he's got some great interviews that he's been doing on Facebook. So those are really cool. Check those out. And these are witnesses to some of these events, including David Fravor, who is the jet fighter pilot, you know, at this 2004 San Diego thing, which we've all heard from him, but Jeremy knows him very well. So this is more in-depth and more lengthy than other interviews.
And I'm considering that he's one of these people that are very cautious, because I've tried to get a hold of him and I haven't heard anything from him.
So, yes, yeah.
Yeah, he's cautious, which is good. You know, I think is a good thing. You know,
I think it's good, too, and it's great that Jeremy is kind of the guy he's talking to, at least because Jeremy is a friend of ours, so he keeps us apprised of stuff.
Right.
And so that's really cool.
Okay, I just got a notice. He's going to be live Friday night. I can't see that text. That was from – hang on just a minute. He is going to be – no, it didn't come up here. Anyway, he's going to be on KGRA radio. That's what I've just gathered by a text that flew over on Skype, which I can't seem to get a hold of. But anyway, I'm sure you'll find out about that if you go to KGRA.com. The notice should be up there on that website. So, Alejandro, thanks so much for being here, as always.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. And we'll talk to you next week.
All right. See you, Chris. You guys have a good show.
Good talking to you.
All right. Well, I guess our guest doesn't really need too much of a introduction.
Yeah, I do. A lot of people don't know who the hell this guy is. Are you kidding?
All right. I'm just going to bring you in. We're talking about stalking the herd, all kinds of great research you've done, places you've lived in, quite a few amazing places. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be back in Maine after 31 years.
31 years.
31 years, and I was only here once, just for an afternoon.
Wow.
And I must say, thank you so much. I arrived. There was a hot, steaming lobster waiting for me.
Yeah, I know. I broke the news to everybody.
Oh, man. I was like, whoa.
I didn't know if I gave you more than one lobster, I might not see you.
No, I probably
would have.
Just
take a nap afterwards.
That would have been too much. I probably wouldn't have been able to make it.
Right.
Make it across the parking lot there.
Right. So go ahead and let the listeners know who the heck you are.
Well, I'm one of those guys that wears helmets and flak vests and spends a lot of time in the trenches. As I've gotten older, I've spent more and more time in the armchair, but all through the 90s, I happened to be sitting and living in one of the most amazing, anomalous areas in North America, with a variety and intensity of unusual experiences reported by locals there that pretty much is unrivaled anywhere, I think, in North America. It's just everything from flying humanoids to, occult crime, to Bigfoot, trooping fairies, every type of UFO imaginable, secret military bases, underground military bases, all kinds of strange individuals that shall remain nameless. It's just an amazing place. The San Luis Valley, of course, is what I'm talking about. Many of my people that do know my work are familiar with the valley. It's the world's largest alpine valley. It sits in the south central Colorado, very extreme northern central New Mexico area. It's like the backbone of North America. America's Tibet. Some Tibetan Buddhists that visited called it that. It's radar invisible below 18,000 feet. It's about 140 miles long and totally surrounded by mountains. And it's just an absolute paranormal Disneyland. When I moved there, I knew that things had gone on there in the past. Of course, the most famous incident would be the first publicized unexplained livestock death or cattle mutilation, even though Snippy the horse wasn't a cow.
That's right. Yeah.
I knew about the place all the way back to 67 when I was a little kid. I remember reading about the flying saucers coming down and snipping Snippy. And when I moved there in 89, I thought that all that stuff was ancient history. And after, it's kind of nosing around a little bit and then all of a sudden having a quite an upwelling of activity in the area in 91, 92. I got involved in really investigating reports that were coming in, and the fact that I was a local with a local phone number and people knew, they eventually got the idea that I wasn't going to be judgmental and exploit them, violate their request for anonymity, credit them when they wanted credit for photographs and reports and stuff. People started to feel, I think, a little bit more comfortable that there was someone local there, and it just the upwelling of it just it was astounding how many reports I was able to investigate in a 10-year period. I must have investigated around 1,200 bona fide reports, out of which about 700-800 ended up in my database. I have a database of unusual, unexplained occurrences from that region that probably rivals databases from other, specific geographic regions in terms of its complexity, intensity, and the variety of reports that I was able to document. And, of course, I ended up writing several books. The Mysterious Valley came out in 96. It was a bestseller for paranormal books. It went through 12 printings. And 12 printings. And then Enter the Valley was the all the historical information and caught the reader up for a couple of years of activity. And then Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, which came out 8 years later, summed up the entire period and kind of gave an idea of what it was like to be an investigator running around investigating some of the most compelling cases on record. I'm quite proud of my work. I've never made a call to the media to promote myself, unlike a lot of field investigators. The first thing I do is call the local newspaper, call the local TV show, and try to promote themselves. Never done that. I've also I've also made sure not to violate people's requests for anonymity, and I worked quietly with five county sheriff's departments, and when they got a report of the type that I've described, I would be the first person that would be contacted, and quite often I went out instead of the deputies, and one sheriff said I was the unofficial deputy of weirdness for five counties sheriff's departments. So I spent 13 years there in the Valley, and I'm quite proud of my work. I investigated over 200 cattle mutilations up close and personal. And my latest book is the textbook, the Bible, the encyclopedia, the case history of that particular mystery. I'm very proud of it. I don't think anybody has even come close to putting the amount of time and effort and objectivity into that particular mystery. And, you know, Stalking the Herd is the go-to book.
Now, when you say, you know, a mystery, and I know that I think I've asked you this before, we know it on my shows, do you have a best guess of what the, or is it still just a plain mystery of what was going on?
It's very complicated. There's no one-size-fits-all answer. Everybody likes things nice and, you know, tied up in a bow in a nice, neat little package. Well, this particular conundrum, Gordian knot, if you will, it defies all simple, logical, single explanations. There's multiple groups involved. Everything from unidentified scavenger action, which is the biggest, I think, sort of cause of a lot of these reports. People seeing a dead cow, hearing maybe that there's mutilations going on in the region, happening upon a dead cow, stopping their car, going out, looking at it, not knowing what they're looking at, and thinking that it looks unusual, and reporting it as a cattle mutilation. If you factor out all those types of misidentified scavenger action cases, you are still left with a body of cases. However, it's nowhere near the amount that some investigators out there with interesting theories. That to me is mystery mongering when you tout every dead cow as being mutilated. Out of 200 cases, I think I had about 40 that definitely appeared to be done with intelligence, using cutting instruments. Out of those 40, about three or four possibly had high heat as a cutting agent, which are very, very disturbing. And the total out of those 40 cases that I feel were real mutilations, that something did that to the poor animals. There were about eight cases that were really, really spooky, that still stick with me years later.
Now, for instance, at the Skinwalker Ranch, there was a report of what appeared as if the cow had been dropped. Its head was jammed down inside of a hole. Did you ever see any cases where it appeared that the cow could have been dropped?
Oh, yeah. Really? Quite a number, yeah. In fact, I found five that we actually... I was down doing interviews with a film crew, and somebody overheard us talking in a restaurant, you know, kind of a little local restaurant. And she goes, "I was coming in. You should go out, you know, on County Road, you know, XYZ or whatever. Go down, make a left, make a right, and then look off by the fence line. And there's some cows out there, and they look strange." So we did. We went out there, and sure enough, all five of these animals had appeared to have been dropped from quite a distance. One of them had all the ribs were broken right on the spine, on the downside, and then one of the horns had been driven into the ground and snapped off. There's no way that animal could have done that to itself, or it could have done it happened with somebody dumping dead cows out the back of a pickup truck. Let's say they looked like they'd been dropped in a pile. There was four, I think three or four cows and a horse.
And a horse.
Yeah.
Wow. Not Snippy.
No. Snippy was back in 67. This is 94, I think.
So I listened to your show on Greg Bishop's Radio Mysterioso. I'm a fan of his show. I really enjoy it, and I suggest anyone to check it out. It's a really great show. So in that show, and I'm going to call this the post-race Stanford show because you also went to race Stanford. So in that show, you were talking about going to race
Stanford. Oh, man, I was excited. Yeah. I was ready to rock. I had 22, 23 hours of videotape.
Yeah.
So, and it just, Ray got cold feet. He just totally backed away from.
Wow. He's listening now. Just
I know. He did. He backed away, Ray. Next time I come down, I'm shooting everything. I kept saying, I should be shooting this. I should be shooting this.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to jump right in and be rude and start filming immediately. I was waiting for him to say, you know, go ahead, you can film this. I gave him plenty of opportunities. And, you know, Ray will at some point, I think, come to the realization that, you know, he just passed his 80th birthday here a couple of days ago. And, you know, the time is right to document not only all his wonderful collections that he has that are just jaw-dropping.
Amazing.
His Chunky Stone collection, I think, is the Ancient Aliens. Yeah, there is really no proof that Ancient Aliens were here. Unless you go and look at Ray Stanford's Chunky Stone collection, then you will see real physical evidence, at least in my estimation. And I think I can echo Ray's feelings about this, that here is real concrete evidence that ancient peoples up to 1,800 years ago, at least in North America, were witnessing extraordinary craft in the sky, which evolved into the Native American game of Chunky.
These discs are like perfect. I mean, you couldn't describe them anything more than perfect UFOs.
Flying saucers. Yeah, complete with the 13 emitters and little domes
and they're right out. They were right in the central United States dug up. Which is really
and most amazing. Of them are made out of meteoritic material, a hematite, and then Ray has one that may be made out of a lunar meteorite. And if it is, it would be the only worked, I think, lunar meteorite ever discovered. And it's impressive. It's big. I mean, we're talking, you know, about 5 inches, 4 or 5 inches across.
I don't think I've ever walked into anyone's house and saw a meteorite until I went in. I can't remember seeing a meteorite in anyone's house except his. He's got a couple of pretty good stones there.
He's got a collection of meteorites that the glass meteorite that Alan Hynek said was the strangest fall of all.
Yeah.
That's a classic. I didn't even get a chance to see that one again. I've seen it, you know, in the past. But, you know, I love Ray. I think he's the only person in the field worthy of any attention. I think everybody else are just a lot of, you know, posers and wannabes for the most part. You know, there are some people that I do have some respect for, good historians, people that have done a lot of work researching and stuff. But in terms of really analyzing the phenomenon, looking at the type of visual evidence that we have, you know, to ponder, I think Ray's work is just so far above and beyond anybody else's work. And of course, his early to mid 70s Project Starlight, his hard data monitoring program, has been an inspiration and a model for my effort in the San Luis Valley of putting together triangulated monitoring array in the San Luis Valley with gravitometers, magnetometers, PZM microphones, and other things to attempt to document some of the amazing sightings that go on in the valley, continuously. So that's something obviously we can talk about more. But Ray is the inspiration for that. When I read about Project Starlight in the early to mid 70s, and then of course Project Hesdalen the Hesdalen project in Norway. Between those two, I think we have the real, I guess the boilerplate, the prototype of how it could be done, and now in 2018 with the level of technology and the price, you know, coming down for tech, you know, we're going to be able to do some pretty amazing things if the phenomenon doesn't play with our heads and try to you know fake us out, but. but we'll see.
Right, right. Now, I think I hope Ray doesn't get mad at me for saying this, but he has said to me that if anyone is really, really serious and takes this really serious and not messing around and they're really interested, he will show them things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's shown just, quite a number of people already.
It's just he just does not want to go into it. Hey, I forgot we went past break time. How about that? So we are going to take a break, everyone. So hang in there. This is Martin Willis with KGRA Radio, and my guest is Chris O'Brien. We'll be right back. We're actually live on YouTube, just to let you know.
Oh. Hey, so, there. Hi, Space Man.
So actually, what I like to do in these live breaks, because we're on YouTube, it's going to go into the podcast, is we just chit-chat off a different subject. We were talking about Ray, so that's how we ended on that one. I set the timer here for 3 minutes, so I don't know if you want to talk about on the regular show, if you want to talk about the Paracast and why you're not on that, or you want to save that for the regular part of the show?
No, I can do it here. I'd rather do it here.
Okay,
yeah, my
ahead.
Levels are really booming too. Audio, by the way.
You've
got to kind of bring me down
Thank
a little
you.
Bit.
Yeah. Okay.
Check 1, 2, 1, 2. Yeah, it's way better.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. So you're not on the podcast after how many years were you on there?
Almost 10.
Almost 10. How about that? Yeah. And what made you decide not to be on there anymore?
It was just time to move along. I think I'd pretty much, what would the term be, shot my wad. I don't know. I'm into a whole new vibe, trying to get the kids involved. Long-form shows really aren't getting the 18 to 35-year-old interested in the subject matter. And as a result of that, I've been working with a new co-host, Ted Bonnet, and we're coming up with a much slicker, modern, kind of multi-platform way of approaching the subject matter. We're going to have a cool geographic app. We're going to have a TV show and a podcast. It's all going to be feeding to a database that's very, very impressive. Each of these things are going to be independent, but they're all going to be feeding into UFO Grid, which is the database.
UFO Grid. Now, if you go on, if you type in UFOGrid.com, it goes to Ted's site now.
Correct.
Which is called something else. I forget the name of it. But so why did he decide not to use that URL anymore? That's been around a long time, right?
Yeah, it has. I'm not really sure what his thinking was on that. I'm just trying to figure out why I don't have this earbud working.
You don't really have to worry about that until we take calls up. By the way, we will be taking calls later on.
There we go.
For those of you listening live in YouTube, also over when we go back live. All right, welcome back. It's Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. My guest tonight is Chris O'Brien on KGRA Radio at kgraradio.com. So we were talking before the break, we were chatting about Ray Stanford and your visit there. What did you accomplish while you were there?
Well, it was good, first of all, visiting with Ray and Sheila.
Sure.
It's been 6 years since I actually was at their house, and I also got a chance to kind of get a dry run through what hopefully I will be at some point documenting, I think, in the future, all his various collections, his pre-Columbian, dinosaur trace evidence, his fossils, meteorites, and then, of course, the all-important, as he calls it, anomalous aerial object analytical work. He's been working for well over a decade, analyzing the many films that he's taken since 1956 of UFO events. And what he's done is he's digitized everything and then put it into a frame-by-frame sequences so that he can then look at the trace evidence that's left in the sky of these events. And it's phenomenal. His observational acuity is off the charts. There's no one I've met that even comes close to how insightful the physical ability to detect trace evidence, whether it's a dinosaur track that millions of people have walked over and he can see, or if he looks up and sees the trackways in the sky based on his photographs and film footage. It's just dazzling. And unfortunately, I'm a pretty bright guy. I've got a good working knowledge of several scientific disciplines, but I mean, it takes every bit of concentration and every bit of my knowledge and the ability to stop him and ask questions. I think it's important when he gets too far beyond me, instead of my eyes glazing over and me just kind of nodding off, like some people I'm sure do when they see some of this very, very intricate information, visual information. I do try to ask questions and try to get make sure that I'm following when he's talking about optical physics, when he's talking about gravitational fields, where he's talking about magnetic fields and in light spectra and how light can be polarized or not polarized. There's certain scientific principles that you really have to have an understanding of in order for what he's saying to make sense. So I'm really, really dedicated to making sure that we have a version of Ray's presentation with Ray actually explaining the information. Sitting there without Ray is only going to, only a few people really are going to be able to decipher what he's done there. Optical physicists, theoretical physicists are going to be able to sit down and understand what he's done based on what he's left behind, let's say.
Yeah.
But with Ray actually sitting there taking you through the process step by step, I think it's very important to get that down on video. And I'm ready. That's one of the reasons why I've moved back to the East Coast is to do this. And I've already got his life in his own words in a transcript. It's been written down. I've spent hundreds of hours with him and then transcribed our conversations about his life. I was able to get all his Uri Geller stories, which are just mind-warping. Which I never did get prior to this.
Uri Geller actually wanted him to tour with him.
To be his battery or when the two of them got together, some pretty amazing stuff. Very, very well documented, too, I might add. Some pretty amazing stuff took place. And initially, the book was only going to be his ufological history and stories, but now we're branching off a little bit.
Carl in the chat room, by the way, I will take a look at the chat room on YouTube, and I have Evan is over there on the KGRA radio. He's over there at the chat if someone wants to communicate a question to get to Chris. So Carl here on YouTube wants to know, do you have any latest – what's your latest news on cattle mutilations? Do you keep your thumb on that? What's going on?
Yeah, I do. There's a couple of interesting chat rooms. There's a Facebook – a closed Facebook page, Anomalous Animal Deaths. And, of course, we do have a loose network of – if you can call it that, of investigators. There's not many people out there that are willing to devote the time and energy it takes to investigate these cases.
Yeah.
And it seems that most of the people that are involved in this particular realm of investigation have already come to the conclusion aliens are responsible for all of this, and that's it. I mean, if you even argue with that, you're the enemy. You are, get away, you're not buying into the alien meme. Well, I think aliens are possibly the least likely explanation. There's only maybe 7%, maybe 10% of the data would support a UFO connection. There's very little, if any, information pertaining to aliens, one or two claims over 60 years. I think the majority of cases are actually a very stealthy, well-orchestrated monitoring of the environment and of our food chain. I think there's a tremendous fear within the beef industry, within the Centers for Disease Control, possibly the National Institutes of Health, some sort of quasi group along those lines, maybe in concert with the beef industry, that's deathly afraid of the outbreak of mad cow disease and then the resulting Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease in humans, possibly blossoming in the food chain. So I think if you look at the work that's been done by Colm Kelleher, who, for many years was the managing director for the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, NIDS, with Robert Bigelow, spent quite a bit of time coordinating all the investigations up on the Skinwalker Ranch in the Uinta Basin up in Utah. Colm wrote a very, very important book that I'm so bummed was so overlooked, and it called Brain Trust. And basically, he laid out the proposition that mad cow disease is the possible motivating factor behind quite a number of cattle mutilations. I'm not saying that's the end all to be all. That's not the one size fits all answer. I have cases going all the way back to 1605 and 1606, and during the early part of the reign of James I of England, right when Shakespeare was writing Macbeth and James was rewriting the Christian Bible, there were outbreaks of hundreds and hundreds of sheep mutilations in and around London. Was able to confirm that. So this is a true mystery. There is a high strange, possibly supernatural or preternatural element to it, but those cases are extremely rare compared to the many, many thousands and thousands of what I feel are human perpetrated cases.
Last time that you were on the show, you really wanted to make me become a vegetarian. I remember you were talking about the beef industry, the methane caused by raising beef. Now, tell me if I'm wrong that you said there's up to 300 cows in a single McDonald's hamburger. Did you say that?
Well, they admit to 100, but there's been with some studies that would suggest it could be as many as 1,000 cows in a single. And if any of them have nerve tissue, that's where the prions hang out. And if there's a downer cow, they used to throw those into the food chain. When a cow was shaking and couldn't stand up and was twitching out, like dementia in humans, these animals were thrown in the pie. Now they're put into pet food. So, if you use your cutlery to take the dog food out of the can or the cat food out of the can, it doesn't matter how many times you sterilize those things, there could still be prions there because you can't kill them. It takes about 2,500 degrees to turn off a prion. So, autoclaves and sterilization and even chlorine bleach can't do away with prions.
Right?
Yeah. So, just a word to the wise.
Yeah, wow. You saw the little chihuahua to try to attack
I did,
you.
Yeah. Yeah, she did.
He eats better than, 90% of the human race.
Actually. Probably, yeah. Most pets in America do. Look at that.
Yeah.
I used to, make my own cat food.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I get a pound of turkey, alfalfa sprouts, chicken livers, a little squash.
Wow.
Grind it all up and then do little single serving things and freeze it. And then one day somebody was house sitting and they ran out of our homemade cat food and put down some Friskies, some dry food, and they would never touch the the good stuff again, cat. Ever.
Yeah. Adster wants to know, have you seen a map that overlays the mutilations with atomic testing?
Yes.
What's the scoop? Is there any correlation to that?
Absolutely. David Perkins, my mentor, who's working diligently on a follow-up to Stalking the Herd. Stalking the Herd has all the data in it, has 12 different databases collated together, and has all the facts. I had to, it's a 600-page book, 500,000 words. I had to take 300 pages out because there wasn't enough room. That is going to be, it's kind of the basis for a follow-up book that's going to analyze all the data. We're not sure what we're going to call it, Stalking the Stalkers, Mute Speak. We have a couple of working titles. But David Perkins, my co-writer and my dear friend and mentor, he came up with a theory and an observation in 1979 that if you take a map of above-ground pollution from 100 above-ground nuclear tests at the Nevada test site, and you look at the wind patterns and how that nuclear radiation has been distributed across the middle and eastern portions of the United States, and then you take a map of high incidence of cattle mutilations and overlay it, it's a perfect match.
Wow.
It's frightening. And, you know, I've always wondered why California, parts of western Nevada, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, they have a few cases, but relatively speaking to what's going on in Kansas, Nebraska, New Mexico, Colorado, there's hundreds and hundreds of cases for every one case that you have upwind of the Nevada test site. So another thing that we've found is that radiation in the environment and levels of copper in the cattle's blood can kick off mad cow disease more prevalent. It can be more prevalent in animals that have been grazing on with residual radiation in their environment. So the combination of copper and radiation in the environment makes cattle more prone to developing misfolded proteins or prions.
Wow. Now, going back to the San Luis Valley, I lived in Colorado for 3 years, but it was in Longmont. You know, I don't know if you know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what part of the state? That's down. Is it down toward Durango? Where is it?
No, that's western. It's a western slope. So, right in the middle of the state. If you go down to Taos, New Mexico.
Yep.
And stand, you know, right there, let's say, stand just north of town there at the Pueblo and look north.
Yeah.
You'll see this huge football-shaped valley. It's 140 miles long. Oh. That extends north. Taos is at the extreme southern end of the valley, uh-huh. geographically, and then the valley extends all the way up into Colorado, 140 miles. So that's the San Luis Valley.
Now, do you know is it still a hotbed right now?
Yeah,
right now.
Yeah. There's last September we had a bunch of reports. 2 weeks it was hot and heavy. In March there were a number of reports. The one Mystic Mountain site on Facebook has been talking about some recent reports around the town of Blanca. My guy down in Mesita, Thomas Pay, has had a number of reports that he's seen. You have to remember, because it's so prevalent there, people have gotten used to it, and it's normal for them.
And how far do you go back in history where people have been reporting?
Oh, the earliest that I can find a report is 1777, when the first Spanish governor of the New Mexico Territory mm-hmm. was chasing a Comanche war chief, Cuenaverde, up into the Huerfano Valley. And as he passed by Fort Garland and made the turn to go around to the east of the San Luis Valley, he noticed up around Blanca Peak, which is the highest mountain group on the eastern side of the valley there, he noticed strange lights, and his troops reported this weird kind of nauseating sort of humming sound or deep vibration in the ground there.
Gee.
So like the Taos hum is what people would call it later, I think.
Wow. And is there any geological aspects that are unique? Like, for instance, Brown Mountain with all the sightings there has a real high copper content of that particular mountain. Do you know of any geological?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's quite a number of interesting features there. First of all, it's the second largest rift valley in the world. Of course, the Great Rift Valley in Africa, which goes up, you know, the eastern part of Africa, and it's where some of the oldest remains of humans have been found in Olduvai Gorge in that area of Ethiopia, and mm-hmm. That is the largest rift valley. The Rio Grande Rift Valley goes from south of El Paso all the way up through New Mexico into the center of Colorado around Leadville. So that's a continuous rift. It's a plate in the North American plate. It's where two sections of the North American plate come together. And so occasionally you'll have super cold on super cold nights with like single-digit humidity. Yeah, I've seen this a couple times. You have the piezoelectric quartz discharging up into the atmosphere from the tops of the mountains.
Wow.
These weird white, like snake-like kundalini rushes going up into the sky that are pretty interesting.
Wow, amazing.
And then there's $2 billion worth of methane sitting out just west and north of the Great Sand Dunes. And occasionally, if the conditions are right, some of that methane gas will illuminate. And I think that's fooled quite a number of people over the years. You also have interesting correlation in close proximity between the Earth's magnetic field. In other words, there are areas where the magnetic field is at maximum strength and then areas where it's at minimum field strength, and they're right butted up against one another. And it seems where you have the close proximity between minimum and maximum field strength, there's like seams, and that seems to be the corridors where a lot of our activity, our ufological activity, tends to be mostly reported along this demarcation zone, DMZ, if you will. And you also have the government. They have the Levita Military Operations Area just over the mountains to the east, and they're constantly flying all kinds of weird, conventional, lit up like something from outer space, conventional craft, and then probably some, black project craft as well. If you want to, get into all that kind of stuff, you got to read my books, because I'm a little reluctant to talk about the government stuff on the air.
I can see why.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to break in just 2 minutes. So as far as did you first move there because you were interested, or did you get interested when you moved there?
No, I originally moved to Santa Fe in 89. And I just happened to witness a fatal car accident and two pedestrian deaths from the crazy drivers there in Santa Fe. And I just took it as the universe saying that wasn't quite the place for me and Deborah. And so I had friends that had a big four-bedroom house up in the little town of Crestone, and up in the San Luis Valley, and they said, hey, why don't you come up here and check it out? And so we went up there just to check it out, and I ended up staying for 13 years. Wow. And some of the most, it's one of the most remote areas in North America. I mean, it's 60 miles in there, a stoplight from where I lived.
Oh, so you think this is developed where I'm living here in Maine?
Oh, God, yeah, this is like...
we have a stoplight, yeah, I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's not real far away, anyway. All right, so we're coming up on the break, and we'll come back in a bit, and we're probably going to ask you about your project that you're thinking about starting.
Yeah.
All right, so... we are coming up in the break. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO, and we are in KGRA Radio, and we are going to take a break, so hang in, stay with us, we'll be back. Do you want to continue talking about the Paracast? You just decided not to do that, but now you're going to be on with, is it Tim?
Ted Bonner.
Ted.
Well, it's, there are a number of reasons why I finally left the show, and I'm sure people that know me and know the show and know the trials and tribulations that have gone into my involvement with the show. I don't want to belabor anything or cast aspersions or complain or bitch or moan or whatever. But I just I felt it for the amount of work that I was putting in there. I wasn't seeing the kind of, it just wasn't worth my time for the amount of effort and energy that it takes to do a two-hour show. It was too much work for too little coming back. I think the main thing, though, is that I really want to move forward in the type of broadcasting scenario. I want to be multi-platform. I want to be talking to, to 18 to 35 year olds. The baby boomers can argue about whether UFOs exist all they want. The kids know they do. They're not interested in sitting there and listening to, war stories featuring Donald Keough and Jim Moseley. These are, people from, ancient history. Even their parents would think that they were old news. So I'm looking to do something much more cool, cutting edge, and less old school.
Did I hear you say it was going to be just like an hour show or a half hour show?
Half hour show.
Yeah. Half hour show.
Yep.
Wow. Do you think you can really dig in a half hour?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can have cliffhangers and, you know, you can wait till the next half hour show. Absolutely. I think that if you can't get a point across in a half hour, whatever that point might be, the kids aren't going to be interested.
Well, I know the attention span is short on, yeah. You know, there's just, and the reason, to be fair, the reason is there's so much information all the time being blasted. Yeah. At everyone's way, that I totally understand why the 2-minute video on YouTube is the one that people watch instead of the you know, 4-minute.
Well, in again, our approach is going to be much different. We're going to have people out in, you know, Ted's going to be out in the field. It's going to be story driven. It's all going to, everything's going to be kicking back to a regional based database.
So. Not much we can say in 28 seconds. So just quickly, where is someone going to be able to find that?
Well, we don't have an actual web presence yet, but the show is going to be called Out There. And we're definitely going to be out there. We're going to be covering all aspects of the paranormal and also consciousness, psychedelic studies. We're going to be branching out and looking at all this stuff under a big umbrella.
Okay. Welcome back, everyone. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. My guest tonight is Chris O'Brien in studio, and I'm glad to have him here. And before the break, I can't remember. What the heck were we talking about? San Luis Valley. I don't know. We changed the subject so many times since then. But we are now going to be taking calls if anyone would like to call in. That number, I'm just going to announce it for those over at KGRA Radio, and also Evan will post the number there. And on YouTube, it'll be up on your screen, and that's 603-967-4030 if anyone would like to call in. We are getting some questions in the chat, I notice, and I will try to get to them, but of course we always like to have people call in. And someone posted this question over at KGRA Radio, and that is, speaking of things washed up on the beach, what about the strange object that washed up on the California beach with a flashing light on top, there for several months? Did you hear about that? I didn't hear about that.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, if we don't hear about it, we can't really comment much on it.
Well, I don't know. Sounds mundane.
Let's see. What do you think of the Eric Davis calm that poltergeist activity always accompanies the UFO phenomenon? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I haven't really dug into some of the interviews and comments that have been done about his interview. It doesn't surprise me. I think John Alexander is someone that's been championing a connection between various divergent mysteries that people would think are standalone and are you know, encapsulated and sort of stovepiped. I disagree. I think there's a connecting point that ties a lot of these various types of mysteries together, and to be followed home from a hotspot location and to have a hitchhiker that all of a sudden then starts pranking you in your house. It makes perfect sense to me, and it doesn't surprise me at all. In fact, I've kind of been saying this for years, that there is a connection between various paranormal phenomena.
Oh, yeah. There are some theories out there I've heard. For instance, Paul Eno has a theory that's pretty interesting. I don't know if you've ever heard of his.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Andy wanted to know if you can comment on any other Gormley/Bradshaw-type sites currently experiencing high strangeness.
Well, it depends on what you mean by currently. I've been gone for the last month, so it's hard for me to comment about anything that's been going on within the last few weeks. The Bradshaw Ranch has been fairly dead, but there was, let's see, about a year ago, third week of September, there was a, an interesting report from out in the Bradshaw Ranch. For some of the listeners who don't know where that location is, that's west of Sedona, Arizona, where I lived for the last 14 years. And an investigator researcher named Tom Dongo worked with the ranch owner, Linda Bradshaw, for quite a number of years, wrote three books about some of the the activity out there. The Sherman Ranch, or the Gorman Ranch, as George Knapp called it in Hunt for the Skinwalker, is the so-called Skinwalker Ranch up in the Uinta Basin. There's constantly stuff going on around there. But as with the San Luis Valley, people are so used to it, and they know that there's nothing good is going to come from reporting activity. They're just going to open themselves up for media attention and for people to, be staking out their property and stuff. So, locals in these areas, they will not report these things to national organizations. It's generally newcomers to the area that get excited and then might mention stuff. All the old locals, the old timers, they will never report stuff to outside investigators. And it takes years of getting to know people, of gaining their trust, of getting them to open up and be forthright about their experiences for them to comment and to publicize these things. So stuff is always burbling along. Of course, we do have peaks and valleys and waves that occur. Right now, I think we're in a lull period. Generally, this time of year, you see activity tail off. And then end of August, beginning of September, it starts to pick up again. It's generally a bell curve around, the spring is heightened activity. It kind of tails off in the summer, and then it raises its phenomenal head again in the fall. That's in a regular year or an off year. When it's really hot and heavy, those are the times of the year that it's really intense. And the summer and winter, you'll have reports, but not as many.
Project.
Yeah, the San Luis Valley Camera and Monitoring Project. It's part of a larger project that the San Luis Valley is going to be the litmus test, the first place where it's really put out into the field and become it will become operational later this summer and early fall. Basically, what we're doing is we're putting up a triangulated system, which means that there'll be more than one camera, ideally three cameras, and each of these cameras will have an accompanying package of sensing hardware that'll be sitting in a box underneath it, and it'll all be connected to the internet. Now, the cameras are really, the technology is amazing now. So for less than $1,000, you can get a very, very good high-res camera. People say, well, why don't you go 4K? Because we don't have the data, the pipeline for the data to go 4K. And, we're going to have some onboard recording. So high def is the extent of where we're going visually, optically. But we're going to have a system that's going to be idling, and you'll be able to go online and see the system going through what we call a patrol routine, where each camera will be going, and then it'll shift to another camera, shift to another camera. It'll be kind of on standby. It'll be on idle. And then we have an all-sky camera, which will be sitting in the middle of the triangulated array, and that basically can see the entire sky. And each of the pixels that are in that display of the entire sky has a number value. And when something happens that either has the luminance, the speed, various parameters that alert us that something unusual is happening, immediately that proximity data generated by the pixels will be sent to the other cameras. They will swing around and focus on the event. So that's what we're going to be looking at optically. And then, boom, you'll see we'll go from a low-res idle status into a high-res status. The software will click on, we'll have recording, and then you'll have targeting boxes that will appear around the object, and then the cameras will then motion track the object, so that if it moves to the left, the cameras will move to the left, and then they'll try to, if it stops for a little bit, they'll try to zoom in. And so we're going to have three different angles at a single event. Now, sitting underneath the camera, These cameras, by the way, have 36 times optical zoom, so we can zoom in fairly close to the event. If it's, you know, within 10 miles of the event, we're going to get some pretty good images.
So this will automatically zoom in?
Yeah, exactly. It depends. The bounding box, if it sits still for a long enough time, then we'll be able to get a zoom on it. Now, underneath the camera will be a series of scientific monitoring equipment that will monitor changes in the Earth's magnetic field, changes in the gravitational field. We'll be monitoring temperature, humidity, wind speed, temperature. We'll be plugged into FlightAware, so we're going to be factoring out any transpondered conventional craft. Any lights in the environment are going to be known in advance. Highways, street lights, house lights, they'll be masked out. And then we'll have two sets of images optically, one that'll have all our data and a time code, and the other just with the time code and the actual object. So it's never been done. We've had, as I mentioned earlier, Ray Stanford did attempt to do this. He had a $2 million single operation with just a single set of gear. We're going to be doing three different sets of gear, and it's historic if we can pull this off and then replicate some of our data and then make hypothesis, actually create a hypothesis and then get follow-up data to substantiate that hypothesis. We're going to be able to have, in conjunction with optical physicists, theoretical physicists, we literally could theoretically write papers for peer review. So this is a logical step forward for hard data monitoring and investigation of UFO hotspot areas. And it's one thing to say, yeah, I was in some special ops group, and when I was in my early 20s, I autopsied 3,000 aliens. It's another thing to get magnetic, gravitational, and light spectra information from a ufological event times three.
Now, when you say triangulate, what type of distance are we talking apart?
It depends on where our exact locations are going to be. This is still to be worked out. But we're talking about a maximum of about 40 to 50 miles per leg.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to have real zoom-in capability.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there's the valley is really neat because it's an open valley. There's no trees. There's very few trees or anything to block the view. And then our main camera is going to be 60, 70 feet up on a cell tower.
Oh, wow. Wow. Now, has anyone ever gotten really good video of events that have happened there in the valley?
Really good video? No. I did have some very, very compelling video that was taken in 1995. Of course, it was stolen from the mail, priority mail, insured, the whole deal. Yeah. The guy, the postmaster at my post office, didn't even know where the form was to report a missing package that had been registered, and the whole thing. He goes, I've never had this happen before.
Jesus.
So that was really good footage. It was of a translucent object that was hovering over the center of the valley. I sent it to Sightings, the TV show, and sorry, Chris, it never arrived. So,
wow.
And nobody signed for it. It just disappeared in the ethers. Go figure. I have night vision footage of third generation night vision footage of 13 objects, two groups, one of seven, one of six, that come together from different directions and then come together and merge for a while and then split and take off. Some of them hover, some go backwards. We were less than 4 or 5 miles away. It was 8 below zero when we took the footage, and there was absolutely not a single sound. And these things were close, and I've been holding on to this for quite a number of years. Most of my footage that I've taken has ended up on some TV show or another over the years. This particular footage I've been holding on to.
Yeah. So you actually saw this particular, this is something
I took it myself.
Yeah.
13 objects. It's the most I've ever seen in a single event.
Wow. Now, do you, when you were in Colorado, did you spend like hours and hours and hours, like sky watching, so to speak?
Yeah, I did. When things were happening, yeah, I did. I spent a lot of time out. I've seen personally dozens and dozens of events. I had a phone tree set up and a network of sky watchers, and we would alert each other when things were going on.
Oh, wow.
I had as many as 17 reports in a single day. So just to give you an idea how how active it got.
Now, is it? Am I thinking of the right places? Is there their UFO watchtower in the valley?
Yeah, it's it's right out, right in the center of the valley. In fact, one of our camera locations is theoretically going to be very close to that. It is a perfect place to put a UFO watchtower. Unfortunately, Judy, the crazy lady that lives down the road, is the title of her book. It's very appropriate, too, I might add. She is not interested in doing the kind of, real meticulous documentation of date, time, event, witness name, location, nice description of the event. She likes to collect stories, and she's got a bunch of them that she's collected over the years. And yeah, it's, people have asked me, well, what do you think of the UFO watchtower? And I say, well, if I was going to put a UFO watchtower someplace, that would be where I'd put it, because it is front row.
And are there, I actually had her on the show one time way back, but are there actually people that do see objects from the tower?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's...
Does she charge? I can't remember. Does she charge?
I think by donation. If you want to stay at her little campground, I think she charges for a hookup and stuff. But it's been a while since I've visited old Judy. She's a real character.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, we're taking calls. If anyone would like to call in, let's see. Bobby, who can't call in because he's working, he can type anyway while he's working. Wasn't Chris watching a game during the Phoenix sightings?
I was.
Okay.
I was working. I was living in Colorado in March of 97. And in February, my brother and I had a adobe plastering company, and we would do real super high quality adobe, natural adobe finishes. Yeah. And one of the Maricopa County commissioners, Dolly Archuleta, or Echeverria, she got a variance from the building commission to build a straw bale in Maricopa County. So we were called down to do all the finish work. And so we spent 2 months down there. And right in the middle of our two-month work period, I was getting ready the following day to go have dinner with Stephen Greer and Tom King and Jim Delatoso and Sherry Adamack, some friends who were down there. We were all going to get together on, I think it was March 18th, and on March 17th, I was watching Arizona State in the Sweet 16, I think, and we were inside our motel room watching the game, and we were hearing hooping and hollering coming from outside, to other rooms. We thought, hey, other people are watching the game, because it was Arizona. I was down in Arizona. I was in Casa Grande, which is between Phoenix and Tucson, right on I-10 there. And then they burst into the game, during, I think it was at the end of the third quarter or whatever, and they said, oh, we have this special news bulletin, I'm standing here in front of the Estrella Mountains, and look behind me, you see these strange lights, and we're thinking, wait a minute, that's going on just up the road. So we all ran outside, and there are people out there going, oh, man, you're too bad you weren't out here about 20 minutes ago. The thing flew right over, and we're like, Wow. We were inside watching the NCAA, Sweet 16, and missed it. It flew right over the motel. So,
I'm sure you probably heard of who was it that was flying their airplane? Kurt Russell.
Yeah. I did.
There's still a lot of confusion about that, because a lot of the film that you see out there is actually the flares.
Right.
I don't know if there's any real solid film of it.
Would think with 10,000 people approximately would see something, somebody would, even pre-cell phone.
Because people were out there because of...
Hale-bopp.
Yeah, Hale-bopp. Hale-bopp.
Right.
Yeah. And so they were out watching that, and you couldn't ask for more of an audience, really.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Ron Reger, who helped to design our DSP spy satellite, wrote the engineering manuals for the optical portion of the satellite. He actually checked the logs for that night, and there was an event logged that started in Henderson, Nevada, and went all the way down the Prescott Valley, and then kind of made a slight turn to the direct south over Phoenix, went down to Tucson, then made a right-angle turn, and went off to the west towards Yuma, and then it disappeared down around the Coldwater Fort Huachaca and the Goldwater Gunnery Range down there.
Well,
the Chocolate Mountains.
The last time I had Peter Davenport on the show, he was telling me that when he was getting calls about the Phoenix Lights, he said that there was someone that was estimating it at being up to 8 miles wide. Did you hear people talk about the size of it? That
yeah, 2 miles is about, I think, what is the closest approximation in terms of taking everybody's descriptions. I think 2 miles would be the most accurate.
Which is absolutely crazy,
yeah,
if you think about it. You know what I mean?
I mean,
yeah, the argument that you know, people say that it was probably something military. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. I had someone on the show recently that says, you know, where would they house something that was 2 miles or a mile?
Well, if it was,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, if it was lighter than air, you could theoretically house something like that. You just deflate it. But or take the helium out or whatever whatever the lighter than air gas was. But it was a physical object, according to Ron Regier. And, you know, he's someone that is above. There would be no reason for him to fabricate a claim like that.
Right. We have to pull in a little closer to the mics here. All right. And so let's talk about. You're talking about this camera unit that you want to get out there. What's the name? It? Where can someone? I know it's on your website, right? Someone can go see that.
You know, we're at the point right now where we're finishing up the triangulation software programming, which will be for the next couple 3 weeks. Then we're going to have a GoFundMe campaign to pay for the rest of the equipment, and that'll be starting in about 3 to 4 weeks. Right around the end of July, third to fourth week of July. And then I'm slated to go out in August out to the valley and get the initial installation process going. And with money, I can pay people and not have to rely on people's, you know, doing favors for me or, you know, dragging their feet. It's been a 12-year process of relying on people's, you know, doing you favors, and I just would rather go out there with a budget, you know, and be sitting there tapping my foot, looking at my watch while people are, you know, getting paid to do what needs to be done, and that is to climb towers and get these things in.
Yeah, you know, speaking of projects and funding and all that, I'm just wondering if any listener that hears this knows any updates on the CubeSat. The CubeSat was supposed to be launched. They raised, I think, $20,000 through a fund situation. And all these people were getting a lot of airtime, and I haven't heard a single thing. So if anyone has information about that, you can actually call in if you're listening live, or send me an email at martin@podcastufo.com.
That was only, what, for just a few months? So.
Right. But it was to go up. We have a caller. Caller, thanks for calling in. Please. Give us your first name and where you're calling from.
Hey, Martin. This is Ryan from South Carolina.
Oh, hey, Ryan. How are you?
Hey, how you doing? I hope I didn't call in at a bad time. I was
meaning
to call in, but
no,
I wasn't sure if there was a good spot.
Yeah. No. You have a question for our guest?
About going back to the cattle mutilations and. I kind of apologize because I was distracted early on in the show from something else, and I assume your guest believes the cattle mutilations are from aliens. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
That's what the popular perception is because of the efforts of Linda Moulton Howe and Chuck Sikowski, Margie Kay, and others that have been touting this explanation as the go-to rationale for these cattle to be discovered in the shape that they're discovered in. And I disagree. I've looked at all the data that's available, and the cases that you can even equate weird lights or some sort of craft are just, you know, maybe 10% at the most. The other 90% are, in my estimation, done by humans, very, very skillful excisions, but done by sharp cutting implements, Not many animals are drained of blood, for instance. There's, of course, there's the popular misconception that all these animals are drained of blood, and that aliens are gathering blood and fluids for hybridization of their dying race and stuff.
Can I stop you right there? And one thing about the blood. That is something you do hear a lot. People talk about that. But I want to ask you, is it because the naturally blood will settle to the bottom?
It's called gravity.
That's what's happening, right?
I don't know how many cases I went out and the rancher says, oh, yeah, they're draining this thing of blood. And I go, yeah, well, here, help me out. And we'll flip the thing over and whoosh, it'll all come out. If you cut into the meat and the meat is slightly pink but mostly gray, then the animal's been drained of blood. Now, I have had some cases where the animal's been drained of blood, but they're rare in the exception. The whole idea that aliens are coming to drain animals of blood and all this is to me is ludicrous. If they wanted that, why don't they just pick the lock on a slaughterhouse and go in at night and there's vats and vats of blood in there? To me, the alien theory is sensational. It's mystery mongering. We don't have the data to back it up. There's no evidence whatsoever to support that particular conclusion, but we have a ton of evidence to support the conclusion that humans are involved. How about all the cases where 400 plus helicopter reports have been filed, or the cases where animals have been shot with firearms and mutilated, or cases where we've had barbiturates, coagulants, anticoagulants, mescaline in one case in Arkansas, nicotides, all kinds of different types of drugs and other foreign substances have been found when these animals have been, when they've done workups on these animals. So there's a huge body of evidence that supports any other conclusion that has human beings attached to it.
Another question, Ryan?
Yeah, well, just a follow-up comment, because, you know, if he said he thought this was from aliens, you know, my follow-up question was going to be, you know, if it's aliens, I mean, why do they always leave so much of it behind? You would think that alien race coming here would take the whole thing rather than just take a little chunk and go running off with and leave the rest, because, you know, you're operating under the assumption that, yeah, they want to conceal their presence here. I mean, obviously they don't announce it. Well, why would they take a chunk and then leave the rest and jump in the ship and take off? That's never made much sense to me.
Well, yeah, and you're absolutely correct. The very fact that the animals are left behind creates a scenario of plausible deniability for whatever human groups are involved. And there are multiple groups, by the way. This isn't one human group. I think there's multiple groups with different agendas, possibly overlapping. And the reason why they leave them behind is very simple. Back in 70, 71, when these cases really started to get noticed and reported, the animals were being stolen. And there was such an uproar in the ranching community that, you know, helicopters were being fired at, and, you know, the utility power line helicopters, National Guard helicopters were being targeted by ranchers who were mad as hell and they weren't going to take it anymore. And so in 72, we had not a single cattle mutilation case. And I think that's when they figured out that, hey, if we leave the animals there, there won't be a police report. There won't be grand theft. You know, there'll be plausible deniability. We can always say it was scavenging. We can always say that or blame it on ritual cultism or Satanists or something. And that creates a veneer of fear. And what can you accomplish by going to a very patriotic portion of our population? Ranchers are some of the most militant people we have in our country. Look at the Bundy standoff, for instance. Ranchers are more prone to being members of patriot groups, for instance. So if you mutilate their cows and leave them behind, you're also manipulating the society. You're actually creating fear, and you're kind of creating a system of control using paranoia and terror tactics by targeting people's livestock. So, you know, I think it's now you're not hearing about these cases very much. Ranchers know that there's no point in reporting them. I think very, very few cases now that occur are being reported. Only the cases where the rancher thinks he's been victimized by the government now are the ones that tend to be reported.
Very interesting. All right. Hey, Ryan, thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks for taking it.
All right. Take care.
Talk to you later.
Bye. All right. So in the chat room, Shane from Australia, used to be on all the time. It's good to see him in here. He is asking, the ones that are not drained of blood, are there ever any toxicology reports on the animals?
Yeah, there are. Not as many as we'd like. Normally, these animals aren't found for at least 2 or 3 or 4 days. And so by the time that they are found, usually during the warmer months, they're already starting to rot and go necrotic. And so there's no point in attempting to try to, you know, do a necropsy or call a pathologist to come out and look at the animal. You know, let's face it, the rancher has already lost his investment. Why would he spend hundreds of dollars on a lost investment? So it's very ingenious the way the thing unfolds. It's almost self-nullifying in many ways.
Yeah, amazing. The whole thing is bizarre. And when I had never heard before until tonight about, you know, going back in history so far, that there was a, and I think for someone that is plain skeptical, most of people will claim that it was, say, a scavenger or something. But you have actually seen with your own eyes the precision cutting.
Yeah,
that just can't be explained.
Well, the first thing I look for, number one, is cut hair follicles. It doesn't matter what kind of scavenger it is, insect, bird, the four-legged varmint, whatever. They're not going to be able to cut hair in a straight line. Coyotes have really bad breath, but not that bad. They're not that talented. And birds, they can't cut hair follicles in a straight line. They tear the flesh in between the hair. And so the first thing I do, and I've been trying to get our, you know, these newer Johnny-come-lately investigators, to wake up and use some very, very good, field investigative techniques to determine the high strange nature of a case. And if the thing has cut hair follicles, something with intelligence and with tools did that. And the other thing that I used to do is when I would arrive at a mutilation site, the more pristine, the better, obviously. The first investigator out of the vehicle would be my brother's Pyrenees dog. And Cato would go out and immediately investigate the entire scene. And we'd very carefully note all his animal reactions to the animal. And we would make notes where he pissed, because that would tell us exactly where the coyotes were. And so then we'd be able to instantly zero in on any coyote tracks and find out how close they came to the actual scene around the animal.
Wow.
Smart. Yeah. There's animals, you know, especially dogs, they could smell, dogs can smell parts per trillion.
Yeah.
And on quite a number of cases, Cato, who normally he's a great Pyrenees, he's not afraid of anything at all. And the very few cases where he would go out and he'd get downwind of the thing and you could see the hair standing up and he'd come back to the car.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Or the truck, I should say.
Wow.
There was only a few, but most of the time he would have no fear at all and he'd run around and any place a coyote would pee on a bush or something, he would have to add his little postcard or whatever.
So how many cases that have you actually physically investigated that did have cut hair follicles, like you're saying?
It's tough to say without going back through the records, but probably at least a dozen, 15 maybe, that had actual cut hair follicles. There were a few others that it was equivocal. There were a few, but not. It's the cases that happen in the wintertime when the horse or the cow, when their hair is long, then you can tell easily. When it's during the warmer months, it's a little bit more difficult to tell. And quite frankly, I really didn't like getting as close to the incisional areas that you have to get to really determine that. And it's my least favorite thing to do in the world, be around 1,000 pounds of rotting animal flesh. It's not for everybody.
Right, right. So we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name, where are you calling from?
Hi, guys. It's Andy from Stratford, Connecticut. How you doing?
Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good show.
What's that?
Yeah. I just wanted to hear, I'm always interested to hear an expert's thoughts on what their opinion is on the connection between, as I'd asked earlier in the chat room, these military, you know, rural farming sites and ranches, is what the connection might be. They all share things in common. Native American tribe, military, rural, you know, and so on. And I'll take your answer off the air, but just want to know if what he thinks the connection might be. That's it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Alrighty. Sure.
Well, I've talked about a formula that I've kind of adopted from Dr. Lewis Turry, who came up with a kind of a rough idea of how to identify a hotspot area or an area that has more activity and a variety and intensity of activity more than other areas. You know, like Sedona is, right, is the Verde Valley area there, the San Luis Valley, parts of the Hudson River Valley, around White Sands in New Mexico, the Uinta Basin, around Mount Adams, around Mount Shasta. There are hotspot areas, parts of the Mojave, Joshua Tree, etc. And one thing that I found is that there are commonalities that exist in all these areas. Number one, they have a history of unusual occurrences that go back into prehistory. There are Native American legends about either flying seed pods, flying shields, sky people, kachinas. There are waves of unexplained activity that ebb and flow through the area. There are Native American sacred sites that are found there. There's unusual geophysical properties, like we were talking about before, the proximity of minimum maximum field strength in the Earth's magnetic field, gravitational lows, areas where you have earthquake faults, that sort of thing. And there is a government presence. The government is definitely interested in these areas, whether they have facilities there, whether they do training routes there. They always seem to have an interest in the area, and they're trying to get more control of the airspace, of the actual land itself. Bradshaw Ranch in Sedona was appropriated by the government. There's areas in the Uinta Basin that seem to have unusual amounts of military interest and government interest. So if you put those five different things together, and an area has and features all five of those things, you have a hotspot area. And that's a place where I'd like to get a triangulated camera and, you know, instrumented scientific instrument array set up there. Ultimately, we're hoping to have these things spread all around North America in hotspot areas and then branching out into other parts of the world as well.
Have you thought about how to keep any vandals away from, you know, like if someone's hiking and all of a sudden they come across this camera, they're going to be curious, you know?
They're going to be in secure areas. There's none of these things are going to be out in the open just for somebody to stumble on. They're going to be, you know, either on people's porches, on their roofs, on cell towers. And people say, well, what if the government decides to take it out? And I say, well, that's great. I hope they do, because then that'll give me information. They'll be prompted to do that because they think I captured some data. And if I captured some data and they take the camera out, then that'll alert me to the fact that I'm on to something. So I think that they're going to try to fool us. I think they're going to play cat and mouse. I think they're going to see how much that they can get away with, whether we misinterpret or you know, somehow misconstrue, you know, maybe some black project that they trot out, or maybe some sort of hologram technology to see if it fools us. I think they're going to actually try to have some fun with us. And it's going to be Tom and Jerry, you know, the little cat and mouse game. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's great. If they do take it out, if they zap it with a particle beam weapon or a laser or something like that, that means that we found something. Yeah. And all we have to do is go back and look at our data and see what it is that got them all nervous.
Well, that harkens back to the Paul Benowitz case in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what happened to him.
Yeah, exactly.
They screwed with him, you know, because he was seeing something. Maybe it had nothing to do with UFOs, but it definitely had something to do with a very strong interest.
Well, I think he was picking up some of the early digital burst transmissions, as I think the audio signals that he was picking up. That's my guess, because that was right when those, when digitized, you know, super compressed blips of digital data were being transmitted. And I think that he may have accidentally stumbled on some of those. Some of his, the color photographs in Chris Lambright's book, X Descending, some of those color photographs of the lighting arrays that he was able to photograph out over the Coyote Canyon area, which is right, you know, where the old Manzano weapons storage facility, which had, I think, more nuclear weapons stored there than any other spot in America. I think that that's all very compelling stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I know that whole X Descending, what a great book. Actually, Ray Stanford.
Ray Stanford's half the book.
Half of that book. That's actually how I first met Chris. I read his book, and we stay in touch. He might be listening. He does listen to the show. Okay, I was just picking up what I thought was a question. But you know, and it's very unfortunate what happened to Paul Benowitz. And I don't know if you've been following this at all, but I'm shocked by what Richard Doty is out there doing. Have you seen any things? He's talking about aliens.
Well, we had him on the Paracast.
Oh, you did?
And, he did a full 2 hours. I think it was the third show he ever did. I think he did Coast to Coast twice, and then he did us.
Wow.
That was a real coup to get him.
It was, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Walter Bosley is someone else. It was, you know, ex-AFOSI and counterintelligence guy. And, you know, Walter's been very upfront saying, look, there's some things that, you know, we just have to be on the lookout for. If we think that, you know, China or Russia is trying to get information about classified projects, and we're going to have to, you know, mount our counter-surveillance efforts to ascertain whether there's some, you know, industrial or, you know, technological espionage going on. And so when someone like a Benowitz comes along and says, look, I got these recordings of these weird audio signals, and I've got these strange photographs, and the fact that he was putting the analysis and spin on it, that it was E.T., gave them a perfect, you know, sort of way to approach him and feed that fantasy to keep him away from thinking that maybe it's some sort of classified Air Force or project out at Sandia there on Kirtland Air Force Base. So going the extra yard and driving the guy crazy and moving his furniture around, which Doty denies, by the way, and you know, putting the groceries, you know, out of one cabinet in the other, and some of the other things that Greg Bishop mentioned in his very, very good book, Project Beta, about the Benowitz case. I think that was going a little bit overboard myself. And if somebody's a little twitchy to begin with and prone to maybe getting delusional and developing mental issues, you know, health issues, I think it's the responsibility of counterintelligence officials and officers and case officers to, you know, to not be in a position to be able to be blamed for a guy's losing his you know, his sanity. It's very, very unfortunate, and there's, you know, you can't make excuses to you know, to explain away that kind of overreach on the fact by the government.
So what type of conversation did you have with Richard Doty about Paul? Was he willing to speak about what happened?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, he mentioned something I had totally forgotten from Greg's book, that they noticed that there was somebody watching them. And they're like, surveilling Benowitz, and then they realize there's a house across the street that's empty, that nobody lives in. There's movement and stuff in there, and so they did they punked who it was, and they found out it was the NSA or some other agency that was monitoring them.
Oh my
so
goodness.
You,
wow.
You don't know how deep the rabbit hole actually goes.
Now, but I watched some part of a movie. I think it was the latest Stephen Greer movie. Lee Spiegel made me watch it.
Excuse me.
Lee forced me to watch it. but Richard Doty is on there saying, talking about like these things are real aliens. On that movie,
yeah,
in that movie, it's like it just blew my mind.
He was saying that too. I mean, come on. Once you're in the business of lying for a living, how is anybody going to take you seriously? The whole Serpo thing that happened, Victor Martinez. If you ever gotten on Victor the Wizard's email list, it's really tough to get off. I don't know how many people out there listening know about the Serpo thing, which is, if you remember back to Close Encounter of the Third Kind, the 13 astronauts in the orange jumpsuits that got aboard the ship. The whole Serpo thing is a story that surfaced in 2004 and 5, I think, that this actually happened, and that two of the people died, and I think one was left behind, or two were left behind on Serpo, which is, I think, in Zeta Reticuli. It's just all a bunch just, how do you do that
this is a family show.
It's all just, I mean, it's hide in your grandma's basement with some Vaseline material. It's just not, it's not worth the paper it's printed on. I there's so many holes in that. And Doty, of course, he says, oh, I had nothing to do with that. But the email that divulged the information, correct me if I'm wrong here, was they were able to trace it back to him, the original email that Martinez got, or something like that. I mean, this stuff is so tawdry. I really try to stay above the fray and not pay much attention to it. But
and then Dulce, of course, all was another distraction for him.
Yeah, that was all Benowitz being led astray. He said, he flew up there and saw a spaceship on the top of the Mesa. Yeah. And I mean, I lived pretty close to Dulce for 14 years.
But there are some weird things going on.
Sure, there's some weird things going on there. But the thing that most people are familiar with, the
underground
Hickory
base. Yeah.
Well, that's all. That's for the outside people. That's just to keep everybody, looking in the wrong direction. The thing that spooks the Indians the most are the little 2-foot dwarves that are seen all over the place there, right in town. They jump on cars in the parking lot of the casino and the Bigfoot sightings. Hoyt Velarde, who was the head of the Department of Public Safety there for years, I've known him for many years. He went out, he says, on at least 100 Bigfoot reports, including one event that he had happen right, up close and personal on his own ranch. Huh. So, and when I was up there in 2009, I saw some really good footage. I wish whoever it was that had the cell phone footage would release it. That's some of the best footage I've ever seen. Thing ran right across the road. It didn't look like some Indian, drunk Indian in a Bigfoot Wookiee suit either. I mean, it was impressive. You could see the whites of the underneath of the feet, and it was running away and in the headlights. So, the whole Dulce thing is, to me, it's...
But there is some... One of the weird things there, I actually... Bill Burns, UFO Hunters, some people may like that show, some may not. I personally like Bill Burns. They saw this strange... half cow, half something else. I don't know if you ever saw that show, but it was really, really bizarre. It was a cow gave birth to it.
Yeah, it was like a genetic. It was just a weird deformed calf. I mean,
that's probably yep.
Yeah. I mean, because of the way these animals, some of them are able to. become friendly with their own progeny and stuff. Occasionally in some of these closed herds, you'll get some pretty interesting genetic deformities and stuff. And that's all that
we
was.
We never want to rule that out.
No,
it's just like, the Atacama baby was definitely, it's
don't tell
explained.
That to Stephen Greer.
Oh.
He'll sue you.
That's true. Yeah. he hasn't yet, and if anyone looks really hard on YouTube, you can find a spoof I did on Stephen Greer on the Atacama baby. So just check it out on YouTube. Yeah, it's the only like karaoke song I've ever done.
It sounds like a rap song. Out of coma, baby.
Actually, whoops, we just lost. I just lost. Uh-oh.
What'd you do?
Hang on. Okay, so here we're back. Okay, I thought we lost the connection here. Good, good. So on the topic of liars, this is Shane from Australia again. On the topic of liars, that's a good opening. Do you have an opinion? Do you have an opinion on Bob Lazar?
Bob Lazar.
A documentary coming out on him fairly soon. Jeremy Corbell is doing.
I don't know what to make of Lazar. I think he may have been profiled in his psych profiles. I think he did work out there. I think he did have some experiences, but I think they may have set him up because he maybe fit some sort of profile for someone that would see things. And even though he wasn't supposed to say anything about it, he may have come out in his profile that he would talk. So maybe they set him up for some really good disinformation so that he would then approach John Lear and then, you know, approach George Knapp. And however that whole disclosure of those Area 51 secrets came out, my eyes glaze over when I hear the name Bob Lazar or Richard Doty or some of these people. I'm into the really trying to get to the bottom of this stuff by exercising the powers of diagnostic science. The people stuff really leave me cold, especially when it's the government trying to get people to propagate memes and disinform the public. I really have no time for that.
There's someone that had just wrote in. Now, I don't know if this is. I don't have any proof of this. It's just what someone wrote in the chat room, and I'd like to. If someone can send me a link, I'm interested to see it. That Dr. Greer is accusing Nolan of academic fraud, and is. There's a court action pending. If someone could send that, I'm interested.
Is accusing who?
Nolan was Martin Nolan. I thought his first name was that, but it may be something else. He was one of the doctors involved in the case.
Oh, out at Stanford. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good luck with that, Stephen. Yeah. I've been telling Stephen at least way back when I first met him over 25 years ago. In fact, I presented a little talk about the San Luis Valley. He was visiting in the valley with some super wealthy high roller types, including Lawrence Rockefeller's right-hand man. And I had been fighting a brush fire and was late, and I was not in a good mood. And when I walked in and he started in on his messianic thing, I interrupted him three times and said, "Stephen, your message is way more important than you are." And that's, people say, "What do you think about Stephen Greer? His message is way more important than he is." And who the hell elected him humankind's ambassador to the universe? And who gives him the right to train people and charge him godly, ungodly amounts of money to become humankind's ambassadors to the universe? To me, it's just,
it's cult.
Yeah, it's ludicrous.
And to charge them for taking pictures of the spaceship that you can't really see, that he's I don't know if
don't get me, that's Will Cocky, and I think now we're getting into the realm of the whistleblowers, and that's where I get in trouble when I start talking about these P.T. Barnum types capitalizing on suckers born every minute. I have no time for that BS. Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left, but you were mentioning, you're thinking that one of the ones that you went, we got 3 minutes to wrap here. So contact in the desert. You're just seeing that things are just New Agey? Is that what it is?
It's going on? People that are so rabidly in the place of wanting to believe that they're looking for anything that supports some sort of weird, dysfunctional narrative that they have in their brain about what's going on. And so David Wilcock and these others are presenting people that are filling in blanks and narratives that have already, false narratives that have already been presented, and now these people are coming along and they're filling in blanks. They're fleshing out the meme, if you will, and it's all entertainment. There's nothing to back any of this stuff up. Emery Smith, show me your DD-214, your separation agreement with the government. Show me that. Let me see. It tells you where you were, how long you were there. Everybody that's been in the military has one. Where's yours? 3,000 aliens you autopsied, right? And how old are you? You don't look like you're even 40.
Now, are you actually witnessing him saying this? Did you witness him say this? Or is this just something
you think I would waste my precious time listening to this guy? I just take cliff notes from other people going, oh, yeah, you should have heard what he said. He said, yeah, he's autopsy 2,000 aliens. It's like, okay, yeah. Whatever. You know, yeah. David Wilcock will come up with some. You know, Corey Good was the last one. Now we have Emery Smith. And Pete Peterson was the one before Corey Good. And Dan Burrish was the one before that. This is all a bunch of disinformation BS, as far as I'm concerned. There's no proof to back any of it up.
There's always, I think, from the very beginning, though, in the UFOs, in particular, the contactee movement, there's always been this sort of fringe element. That's all I think will always be there. But do you think it's growing?
Yeah, it's like a virus.
Yeah. And what would you say to, like, the listener to protect themselves from it? Just, you know, for advice, what would you say?
Well, first of all, you know, question everything.
Yeah.
Don't believe anything. Don't suspend your disbelief just because you want it to be true. Number one, do due diligence. Do your research. Find people that you respect and that are objective, that aren't going to give you a bill of goods and fill your head with bad science fiction. And do your own research. Don't sit in your armchairs and believe and accept everything at face value.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I agree. So if someone wanted to contact you, do you engage with them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Go to ourstrangeplanet.com. It's a strange planet, Martin. It's our strange planet. and then very soon we'll have some announcements about the GoFundMe campaign for the San Luis Valley Monitoring Project. And also we're going to have a website and a streaming, you know, the actual images, the patrol function will be streaming 24/7.
Wow. Great. Excellent. Hey, Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks for the lobster, man.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah. All right. So, everyone, we are going to call it a night. Thank you so much for listening or watching on YouTube or over at KGRA Radio. We'll be back next week, as always. And next week's guest, and I just want to make sure I have that right, because that is Jennifer Stein. So we're going to be talking a little bit about crop circles. That'll be kind of interesting. I saw her, you know, I've been leery. It's kind of like the cattle mutilations. I don't know if there's any, I don't really see any connection. But Jennifer does such a great presentation. I said, you know, I'd love to have you on your show to hear you do that again, because it was really good. This was when I saw her out in Phoenix. So thank you so much, everyone, and thanks for listening over at KGRA Radio. And I want to thank people that helped out with the show. First of all, Evan for helping out behind the scenes. I want to thank Peggy for managing the Facebook page, Race, over at KGRA Radio. And I know I'm forgetting people, but thanks for listening. You're the most important. Couldn't do the show without you. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky
and your ear to the ground.